When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. I've always loved the merger of health, fitness, mindset, and how, you know, one is not resolved without the other. You can't just focus on one and forget about the other one. And I think we're drawn to life's changes and our own transformations through frictions in a doorway is usually one of those things. So I love that today's guest finds you through any of those doors. Chris Menz, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So not just a coach, but also the author of Man the Fuck Up.
Which, yes, sir.
Way to take that term and turn it on its head.
And that, yeah, that was the idea when I wrote the book, and I'm sure we'll get into it. That phrase, it, you know, plagued my upbringing, and it was framed in the way that most people believe it is. You know, that title can be triggering and good, you know, because I really want people to feel something when they hear that title. And for me, you know, I heard the term "man the fuck up." It meant, you know, grow a pair and all these things guys hear about suppressing their emotions. And so when I wrote my book, I wanted to flip it on its head, like you said, and give it a new meaning, which is essentially that, you know, there's lots of beautiful qualities about being a man. And a lot of the times we are missing that emotional intelligence piece. And so through personal stories and things like that, I believe I accomplished that.
What made you write that book, and what made you go into this work, I guess, more specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, it was about, I always felt like I had a book in me, and it was through breaking, you know, my own glass ceilings of masculinity, defining it kind of for myself, being okay with that, and realizing that there's lots of guys out there, lots of friends of mine who were in that same boat of wondering, if I show emotion, is that going to mean I'm masculine and all of this stuff? And really, it was a book that I needed. I wish I had it when I grew up. You know, I listened to your last podcast with your guest, Lindsay, there, who said the very same thing about her book. And I felt that, because this was really a book that I needed. And I felt compelled to write in order to move the modern masculinity forward in our world, in our society.
It feels like it's moving forward pretty substantially now, but, you know, I recognize that I'm probably in a bit of an echo chamber sometimes. And, you know, the conversations that, you know, when someone says to me like, "Oh, where are the good men?" I'm like, fuck, I really only know good men. Like, 100%. I don't know shady men.
100%. That's a great point. And, you know, I actually talk about this in the book as well, is, you know, being conscious of your environment, doing an environmental scan. Because if you talk to Chris 6-7 years ago, I was hanging out with, you know, lots of people that weren't serving me. And this was before my own transformational journey. But now I seek out like-minded people. And so, yeah, the very same thing. If someone were to say that to me, I don't know where all the good men are, I'd say, well, come hang out with, you know, me and my friends for a weekend. You might find a few. You know, it's really about when you go through your own transformations, you realize what you need in your life. You seek that out, and like-minded people find each other.
And so much our narrow vision that can only see, you know, what we believe about the world. And then all of a sudden, if our, you know, through your experience of, you know, having some version of an awakening, yeah, you start to, which was the same for me, you start to see, you know, not necessarily the people I hung out with, because a lot of them were actually pretty good. It was that it was who I was. It was actually like the window into me of like what I valued and how I spent my time and the choices I made, and not just like what I valued internally, but what my choices were verifying what I truly valued deep below, which was not in congruence with what I would say was my soul's desire for expression.
Yeah. And I only learned this saying, obviously, through my own personal growth journey, but you know, that whole thing around you are what you attract. And that's really where I was at. You know, a bit of my story is I self-medicated for a lot of years. And when I trace that back, because we should all get curious about our triggers, you know, why are we, when we're in a flooded state, you know, why is that? Get curious, because otherwise it's going to continue to have power over you. And it's not a good feeling. And so when I got curious, I realized that, you know, my whole trajectory, the way it was going, stemmed from when my parents got divorced and I was 13 years old and my dad came out as gay, and it was completely out of left field. I was not expecting that at all. We had the perfect family. Everything was great. And what happened was, is that bred a belief in me that no matter how much love, no matter how much trust there is, that it can be taken away from you in an instant. And so that created an anxious, attached, codependent Chris who would kind of operate that way throughout, you know, my early relationships in high school and then into my 20s. And so I quickly, you know, I found pot and I was, you know, a pot smoker for, you know, 13 years of my life. And throughout that time too, you know, was using other drugs recreationally, which got a little bit more heavy into my later 20s. And it was only until I got divorced in 2001, or sorry, I'm sorry, 2021.
I was like, damn, how old are you? Yeah,
I'm starting early.
Yeah.
No, 2021, where I had that, you know, cathartic moment. What was I doing with my life? What kind of example did I want to be for my kids? And I made a switch. I can remember, I remember the day that it happened. And I remember the sounds and everything. It was my last day in the family home because, you know, bless my ex, we were able to really transition beautifully like no one else. I lived in the house for another 7 months so we could transition and talk to, you know, our oldest one and really do this seamlessly. And anyways, it was my last day in the family home, you know, tears pouring down my face. It was a really, really rough day. And I get to my apartment, which was partially furnished. And I remember placing my keys down on the counter and there was this echo throughout the house. Mm. And I just broke down because it just symbolized emptiness. There were no memories in this place. There was no nothing. And the next day I get up, you know, I light a joint like I normally do. I took a couple puffs. I said, that's it. And I put it down. And now years later, haven't touched it. Haven't touched anything else. And it was just, you know, it doesn't happen like that for everyone, but for me, it was just a light switch that went off. And that was kind of the beginning of my personal growth journey, so to speak.
Why did you quit that day? Like, what was the recognition as you're having a couple of tokes that you're like, I actually can't do this anymore? Why?
Yeah, that's a great question. What it was is all of a sudden I realized how it was holding me back and how I was justifying its existence in my life for reasons like, it makes me more creative and, you know, I'm more social and things like, none of that was true. It was really when I would smoke or, you know, have a few puffs, it really brought out all the demons in me, the insecurities, and I just all of a sudden realized that because when I had those couple of puffs, I started to go back to that dark place that I was the night before. It was almost palpable. It was more intense than it had been. And I didn't want to feel that ever again in that depth. I wanted to have control over my mind so that if I'm in those places, I can actually start to attack those moments from a place of growth, if that makes sense.
I'm curious from the beginning of that part of the fracture in your early childhood journey. How old were you when your parents got divorced? You said 13?
13, yeah.
Yeah. So your parents get divorced. You said you guys didn't see it coming. You have siblings?
I have a younger brother. He was 11. We talk about it sometimes. He doesn't have much emotion from that day. He was, you know, 13 through my reading and research on this seems to be the shittiest age for that to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's such an identity, like your identity is so fragile at that age. It's like
right there.
You're between adolescence and
Puberty's hitting all of that stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like socially, there's structures being formed at school. And, you know, I just remember from 11, 12, 13, just watching social hierarchies being created and me staying at the bottom of them. Would you say that your family system handled that process and transition with answering your questions and being open and your mom and dad talking about the challenges of like your dad coming out as gay and like, what does that mean for your mom? And, you know,
that's a great question. Yeah, I'm curious. Early on, I would say there wasn't enough attention on that. And I believe that that's because it was new for my dad. It was new for my mom. Like I found out that my mom knew a year before, and similar to me with my divorce, they were kind of taking that year to really decide, how are we going to do this transition? When are we going to tell the kids? My mom needed time to digest and
everything. That's like big.
It's big. And actually, funny enough, my mom wrote a book as well many years ago called All These Years. And it was basically her story about, you know, it flashes forward and back in time from when my parents met and they were having their relationship, and then fast forwarding to kind of when they were going through things. It's very, very cool, well-written book. And I found out a lot of different things in there, as you can imagine. So that,
I bet reading it, you're like, this would have been helpful.
Yeah. My mom's adorable too. 'Cause when she presented us with the book, she actually, took the time to go through the pages and put sticky notes over parts we might not want to read, and then we can choose to take them off.
Yeah.
And obviously I took them off. I want to, you know, you wrote the book.
You're like, shit, I'm going to go to all the sticky parts.
I know. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But, I would say that sort of realization and that information came more as the years went on and as my curiosity peaked and I asked the right kind of questions and things like that. So initially, no, it was one of those things where I was kind of navigating on my own a little bit.
It would be hard to navigate on your own though.
Like
the process. I just couldn't imagine being 13. And like, I would imagine your mom is processing embarrassment, shame. Your father is processing all the things, especially because, you know, that was however many years ago.
Yeah.
And were you in Manitoba at that time?
No, I moved from Manitoba in grade 4 going into grade 5. So I was really young. This happened in Vancouver in 1999.
I mean, at least you're in Vancouver. At least it's relatively progressive.
Yeah, so exactly.
You navigating that, how did you process that, like telling your friends and stuff? What was that like?
I kept it quiet. I was a little insecure about it.
Yeah.
You know, there was, you hear words and things that, you know, don't care to share, but you can imagine, you can fill in the blanks of, you know, jokes being told about that demographic. And so it definitely made me shy, and I kept it quiet for a long time, and it eventually ended up getting out. And it wasn't a bad experience. There was a lot of support and things like that, and which was nice. But it wasn't on my accord. I remember the day that my best friend who lived next door asked me the question outright, you know, is this true? I heard this. And I did tell him and I confirmed, but it was a nerve-wracking thing, but it was equally as special to find out that there was support behind it. And all my worst fears were not realized when that information, you know, made its way to the public, but it was good.
At that time, were you into health and fitness, mindset, that kind of stuff, or?
No. Oh, God, no. No, I was still running around doing, you know, nonsense and things like that. It wasn't until 2021 that I started
the divorce.
Yeah, exactly. Before that, I was exercising just for myself. Nutrition was but I was physical, and I have been into exercise since I was about 16, 17. So it's been a while with that. And then just sort of you know, learning little tidbits and getting my act together. But I started taking it very seriously, even on the nutrition side, I'd say about 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah. And you and your ex-wife, it sounds like you navigated the ending of that relationship really well.
Beautifully.
Yeah. And so a lot of the personal growth stuff that's come since you got divorced, clearly you were self-reflective before that. Like clearly you were having these types of conversations.
Yeah.
I would imagine. Were they just not explicit?
That's a good way to word it. They weren't explicit, and they weren't, I was having a lot of the right thoughts and the right reflections, but I didn't know how to articulate them. Like I didn't know what anxious attachment was. Yeah. I just knew what it felt like. I didn't have a way to describe it. And so when I reflect now on, you know, potential opportunities in that relationship, ways I could have shown up better, because at the end of the day, relationships are a two-way street, but you can only focus on your side of the street, you know? And so I didn't get out of that relationship, you know, picking apart what she did. It was really, where's my opportunity? Because clearly I'm the common denominator in all of the relationships I've had throughout my life. And while I can feel the growth in each one, there's always opportunities. And so, yeah, we would have some of these conversations, but they were really messy in the sense of not toxic, but messy. You know, we didn't kind of know how to articulate kind of what was going on. But, you know, I've been through therapy and things in my life and have gained knowledge along the way, but it really became proactive, like I said, in 2021 after the divorce, because I was kind of like, you know, enough's enough. I want to really, you know, remain solid and not feel these ways. And when I, you know, get triggered and, you know, I'm feeling anxious and unsafe and like I'm going to be abandoned. Well, why is that? And how can I kind of control my side of the street a little bit better?
Yeah. You know, years ago, I wrote this article that was called Love Her Before She Leaves You. And the whole idea about it was because I was reading all about the impact that divorce has on men versus women, and that women initiate divorce 70% of the time. This was the stat at the time. And it usually takes about 2 years from sort of like the, hey, I'm not happy or things aren't good, can we do something about this, to I'm out of here. And right. I started to see just like that when women get divorced, they turn towards their husbands or partners like 30-something% of the time for social support, but they turn to friends 60-something%. And it's actually the inverse for men in a heterosexual relationship. So we turn to our partners 70% of the time. So when we lose our relationship, we actually lose our social emotional support. And then we're more likely to get remarried. And I think so often we're more likely to get remarried because we're not told how to go emotionally inside and actually hold grief and loss and shame and all of that. So we don't have this sort of cultural template on how to do that. And then secondly, I think we're unconsciously just trying to find another way to insulate ourselves and to like find another sort of Band-Aid,
yeah.
You know? And it's so great to hear that you used your breakup, your divorce as this catalyst. And I think for men and women, to know that that's actually like, we're sitting on the most powerful form of transformation when we're sitting on divorce and grief and loss and breakups. Like we don't
realize.
Like think, you put down a joint. You probably thought about putting down a joint so many times before. Maybe you didn't.
So many.
Yeah.
So many.
But then there's just something so magical in a very hard way about the perfect ingredients of situation, the amount of self-reflection, the lack of family around you, the echo, which is so ominous. I can just hear it myself, you know, of like, oh, there's no memories here. Yeah.
You know, what's interesting. And a part of my journey was really getting fascinated on the brain and how it functions and how it really wants to keep you comfortable, even if that comfortability is not serving you. And that's what, you know, like you said, you probably thought about, you know, putting down the joint a few times, 100%. But when that dust would settle, when that little, that would be a little glimpse of reality, a little bit of that other side of the brain saying, no, this isn't serving you. And that's the side that, you know, we really should listen to. For me, there's that comfortability side of things where it's like, oh no, you know, the dust has settled on that. The brain wants to keep you comfortable. This is what's comfortable. And so time and time again, I would go back to it. And it's very interesting too. Like, you know, you mentioned it's a shame, and it's not 100% of the time, but most of the time we require sort of these trials and tribulations in our life to really make those changes. It's almost like a rock bottom to make a change. And it would be really nice. And I think, you know, it's possible through growth and recognition and understanding yourself to make those changes without the presence of that type of pain. But most of the changes in my life have come through very, very tough moments in life. And, you know, I'm blessed for the change. I'm blessed for the trial and tribulation that led me to that. But I only think about that sometimes. It'd be really nice if, you know, we could make those changes without all that pain, you know?
Shit, that'd be, I mean, I think you're preaching to the choir, to the choir of all the listeners too. It's like, man, why does that have to, I remember I used to chew tobacco and I wanted to quit. And I quit the day I broke my leg when I was laying in the hospital and I was in the hallway going to get a CT scan because my oxygen levels were low. And I was laying in the hallway and I'm like, I'm actually doing something that is going to speed up my mortality. Like, how arrogant to do. And it took that level of like confronting death and confronting the realness of my choices. And I think about like all our choices are either life affirming or death affirming. It's hard that it's that straight of a binary, but it is that straight of a binary. Like, is your choice expanding you or contracting you? And marijuana is interesting because I think a lot of the times we do use it as, and it's legalized in a lot of places now, but we use it as this numbing mechanism. And I get if you're an alcoholic and all of a sudden you're only smoking weed, that's considered, you know, harm reduction. You're probably doing less harm. You're crushing more potato chips, but that's about it. But you're still harming yourself. You're still numbing yourself from what's below that. You know that feeling you get when you crawl into a freshly made bed of silky bed sheets? It's probably my favorite feeling in the world. I've been traveling a lot lately, and every time I go to sleep in another bed, I miss my home. I miss my cozy earth sheets. I gotta tell you, these are the best high quality sheets I've ever had the pleasure of sleeping on. And even my wife, Kylie, will agree, there are no other sheets that compare. They're soft, they're silky, and so comfortable, and you literally just melt into them. The reason they're so soft is that they're made from viscose from bamboo fabrics, which is softer than cotton. And as a huge bonus, it's responsibly and sustainably sourced. On top of that, it's temperature regulating, which means it keeps you cool and comfy all night long. And the unbeatable luxury feel helps turn your bed into the most cozy sanctuary ever. And I'm not the only one who's crazy about them. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's favorite list 7 years in a row. So give their sheets or any of their awesome products a try. They have a 10-year warranty on all their products and a 100-night sleep test to try it for 100 nights. And if you don't love it, you get your money back. But I know you'll love it as much as I do. And they're offering you, my listeners, a massively generous 40% off discount. So go to CozyEarth.com and use Mark at checkout for 40% off all their products. That's CozyEarth.com and use the code Mark for 40% off. So I'm curious, what did you find below marijuana? Like when it was removed, then what surfaced?
That was a difficult transition because essentially it was almost clouding doors that were closed and I didn't realize needed to be open. And then when the smoke cleared, so to speak, no pun intended, there are these doors that now I need to kind of look and confront, which was, you know, what was behind it. And it was equally scary and liberating. And I think that the liberating feeling caused the fear to subside a little bit. And, you know, I'd listen to during, you know, a personal growth journey, obviously it's really important to, you know, read books and listen to podcasts and things like that. And that was a huge part of my transformation journey. And I remember getting to this point though, where I was listening a lot but there wasn't a lot of application. You know, you always hear that saying that knowledge is power. Really, knowledge is power when it's applied. And so the first part of my journey was doing a lot of listening, doing a lot of knowledge gathering, but the application wasn't there. And so then again, you know, that's just about, well, I feel stuck. How can I move forward? And so it was a lot of, you know, peeling those doors open, finding out what was behind them, getting curious as to, you know, why I was feeling the way that I did. And once I did that, it didn't feel as scary. You know, it felt like I had more control of my life. And, you know, fast forward later, because obviously during my tenure of substance and things like that, obviously drinking was a component. And that was kind of the last thing to go. And I wasn't, you know, drinking heavily like I was. It would be more, you know, a beer or two every couple of weeks when I go out to lunch with someone. But I started to notice that even that was affecting me. Even that was changing the chemistry up there. And so I made a decision August 6th of 2022. I'm done. Let's just see what life is like without that. Let's try a new journey. And I think that was actually scarier than putting the joint down, because it's such a social thing, and it's so, you know, everyone drinks, and it's, you know, commercials and movies and everything like that is just such a part of the culture. And so I had these fears that, you know, is anyone going to want to hang out with me? Am I going to be fun anymore? And so I had some insecurities around that. And so I think that was scarier. But, you know, ultimately for me, the most important thing was moving my life forward and doing what I needed to do to get to my next level of humanity, masculinity, career, fatherhood, everything like that was the most important thing to me. And so, you know, here we are.
And I remember that feeling of feeling called to quit the next thing and the next thing. It was like everything that robs you from presence within yourself. And I was listening to Carolyn Mace recently, and she said, you can tell when you get guidance from God because it's annoying.
That's a great saying.
And I was thinking, like, yeah, that's how you should quit alcohol. You can't do this anymore. You need to stop whatever behaviors they are. But you realize that when you do stop them, you discover a higher level of trust in yourself and a higher level of discernment, but then you're also more present. And I think the more you heal whatever's going on internally, the less you want to numb from being within your own experience, you know, within your own mind. Yeah.
I was going to say, I just, for me now, I really appreciate doing things intentionally, you know, and asking myself questions. Like, for example, with drinking, you know, sometimes, and it happened last summer, it's a hot day out on the beach, and it'd be like, oh man, you know, it'd be nice to just have a cold beer. You know, I remember that, and it'd be nice to have a cold beer. And then just starting to ask myself, well, why is that? Why do you want to have the, and actually answering those questions, you know, none of them were good reasons, you know, based on what the other side is. Okay, well, what would be the reasons for not? And the reasons for me for not would be, well, it could be derailing your personal growth journey. You might have those feelings come up again of insecurity. And you remember how your brain kind of switches when you do that. And those answers always outweighed it. However, if the answers on one side are genuine and, you know, there's a good reason for doing it, I don't know what that reason would be because I haven't found it yet, but I like doing things intentionally. And I think that that's a great way to live. If, you know, if you're somebody who is kind of struggling with different things and finding it difficult to get out, you know, just getting more curious, asking yourself those questions. Why?
Yeah. Why am I doing this? Why do I want this thing? What am I going to get?
Exactly.
I think that about the beer too on a cold. I mean, that's a great example because, you know, it's like, what a time to have a good brew.
Yeah.
And to me, it was also that alcohol was so connective. You know, as you said, it's so socially woven into the fabric of everything.
Yeah.
That to quit alcohol in the context of the culture we're in is actually to heal codependency. Because so much of it is this, like, there's a social expectation that I'm going to drink. And so if I'm willing to break that agreement and allow what comes forward, then that means I'm willing to honor myself in the face of other people's disappointment or expectations of me. When I realized I was not quitting drinking because of how other people might see it or feel about it, that's when I quit, because I was like, oh, well.
Yeah, and that feels out of control. Like, that's essentially giving society and people outside of yourself control over your decisions. And that's something that, you know, in my day and age today offends me greatly. You know, I don't want to feel like peer pressure, anything like that. And I remember I got it a little bit going out on boys' dinners and something. And I'd say, you know, I'll have a Virgin Caesar or something. Virgin Caesar? What are you doing? What are you talking? And then, you know, I'd have to navigate a little bit of that. And
had you written your book yet at that point?
No, I hadn't written.
Yeah, I was going to say that'd be a good time to hand them a copy.
100%. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I kind of got the same thing a little bit, but it was only from very few people. And it was usually from guys. I just was not like, they were still kind of caught in that same cycle of like talking about chicks or talking about, whatever. Where it was like, oh, well, you're going to have a, what are you, gay? You know, like that type of exactly. dialogue where you're just totally. Like,
are you
really?
Still saying things like that for real?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's good though. You know, I talked earlier about doing that environmental scan, and I talked about, you know, we talked about where all the good guys and things like that. I had, you know, a vast group of friends, but I realized it was all centered around partying and substance and nonsense. And I think about some of the conversations we had, and I was like, did I just spend my time or invest it? Because I feel like I'm spending a lot of time, you know, the difference.
Oh, that's
right?
Such a great question. Yeah.
So now I have maybe a handful of good friends, and, you know, we'll see each other from time to time. Obviously I'm, you know, very focused on building my business, being a family man and everything like that. And that's all great. That's, you know, the life we live now. But I thought I would be more upset to lose friends like that. But really, it's, you know, I'm very happy with the core group of people I have now and the conversations we're having, and how, you know, there's always some kind of investment when I'm hanging out with these individuals. And that, just that environmental scan, that information that, you know, oh, you're ordering a Caesar. What are you talking about? Like, you know, thank you for that information, because, you know, that'll be the last Virgin Caesar that you see me order. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. When you were on this journey after your divorce, what was it that you became like, where did you see your greatest struggles that led you to write the book for other people to understand? Like the struggles, I suppose, that you saw within yourself that then you were resolving, that then you saw so much in the people around you.
Yeah, that's a good question. Hopefully this answers this. This is just kind of what came to my heart right now. Is I'm a guy who loves love. I've loved it for ever since the divorce, because I, you know, subconsciously I was trying to recreate it throughout all my relationships. I was trying to fill that piece of what I had. And I would just, my relationships would never last more than the 3-year mark. I think there were 3 or 4 relationships in a row that was 3 years, seemed to be, you know, the magic number. And then when I met my ex wife, that was my longest relationship. And so inside I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is going to be it. We get married and oh my gosh.
I mean, past the 3 years.
I did it. I finally did it. And so when that, obviously, you know, it didn't work out, I was like, no way I'm back here. There, I really need to look at my stuff, because clearly there's something on my side that it's not working. There's something that's off. I feel it. And I know it was a lot of that anxious attachment codependence, which now I actually had a definition for and understanding, so I could start to dive into it more and read more and listen more and all these aha moments. And so I talked about it earlier. It was really breaking through my own glass ceilings and imagining if my kids ever had to kind of go through this. I dedicated my book to my kids, really thinking about young Chris, young 13-year-old Chris, or even in my high school, if someone were to hand me this book, man, what an awareness that would have been for me, and would have really helped me along, I think, through some of those relationships. And I'm not saying any of them would have lasted. But I think from my side of it, it could have given them a better a better chance. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it was really getting sick of loving love so much and having it fail time and time again, and just trying to realize why was that and what was happening on my side of the street that was causing these downfalls.
What are some of the core premises that you find everyone needs to understand to have that level of emotional self-reflection and then bring that to relationship?
You know what one big one is? And I was going to say, I'm embarrassed to say that it took me this long to realize, but just the different relational needs of men and women and understanding what women really need. A lot of the time I was operating, like I said, in an anxious attachment, codependence. I would brand myself as an easygoing guy, but really I was the nice guy, meaning like people pleasing and all of that. And that would be a lot of the downfall. I wasn't focusing enough on emotional safety for my partners. And, you know, my love language is physical touch and words of affirmation. And they kind of switch back and forth. You know, I do that quiz to find out kind of where things are at, how my life's changing, you know, maybe once a year or something like that. And so they seem to always interchange. But a lot of the time, physical touch isn't one of the top ones for women I found. It is important, but I wasn't focusing enough on emotional safety and security for my partners. And that was a big one. Even in my current relationship now with my girlfriend, Shannon, it's been a vastly different experience to all of my other relationships, because we are both in a passionate solo journey to discover more about ourselves and therefore the relationship and how can we navigate. And since focusing more on emotional safety and security, not only do I create that safe space for intimacy, but a whole world has opened up just from focusing on that category.
When you look back now, what is the skill that you've learned that's made the biggest difference?
Skill in which way?
Relationally or just in life, just that you've developed and cultivated.
The biggest skill would have to be in moments of trigger, and this is very difficult for any anxious attached out there, to actually pause from a conversation and take time. If you feel that you are starting to get into an elevated state, us anxious attached, we don't want to go to bed angry. We want to fix and fix and fix, and actually being able to step back and recognize in the moment, you know, let's take half an hour from this. Let's just kind of reflect on our thoughts, give us a chance to, you know, kind of come down from an elevated state. And then we can come back with an open heart to have this conversation and empathize with the other side. That's by far the biggest skill that I have learned to operate. It's not perfect 100% of the time. I'll be happy to admit that, but compared to before, it's a night and day situation, and the outcomes are night and day as well.
That shit's the hardest, man. Like if you're in an activated state and you could feel it and you know that you just want resolution or resolve, or you want to be heard and affirmed, that you're like, deep breath, I'm just going to let this sit. No, oh God, I'm the same as you. I'm like, okay, I can do that most of the time.
Yeah.
It's not all the time.
Yeah. I give it about 75-80%, I'd say, yeah, which is good odds.
The same.
It's good odds.
Well, and of course, generally, I mean, in my experience, I've been in relationship with people who are more prone to avoidance. So
okay,
being able to measure in, I'd say that I have a hypersensitive radar to it. So any sort of like distancing or pulling away or shutting down, I'm like, oh, come on, let's resolve this.
I know.
Yeah. For the old avoidance, staying a little longer, that's a little harder to do. You know, that's the other invitation.
For sure. And, you know, recognizing too that those flooded states come from somewhere. Obviously, our, you know, relationships are a mirror and they're reflecting things back to us that we need to work on and everything like that. But also coming to the realization that if I'm triggered in the moment, you know, a lot of the time it might be unintentional from your partner, and realizing that that trigger is coming up from a historical wound. And that now ego is getting involved to, right, like you said, have your voice heard. Sometimes, I don't know, maybe get the last word or want to fix things really quick, whatever the case may be, recognizing that it is that. And like I said, if you can, and it many years of practice, I'm telling you, Mark, for this, but if you can separate yourself just for a moment, I've come back as quick as 5 minutes sometimes to just like, whoa, I just kind of had this reality. Okay. That went a little, it's like, you know, the red had cleared and come back and, you know, sometimes it's an hour, whatever the case may be, that time is so precious and can make such a big difference between a fight that lasts, you know, a day or two into one that lasts 20 minutes. And once you realize that that can be the outcome, it's always those first couple of times actually seeing what an outcome can be if you actually take that time. That's how the brain kind of switches. And that's how it's become easier for me is when I've taken that time, I come back and I see how, wow, that resolved nicely. That actually, you know, accomplished what my, you know, recovering anxious attached style wanted is a fix as quickly as possible. It's a special thing if you can do it.
Yeah. When we get there, you're right though. It takes time. And every time you get more evidence that you can. I'm curious, what made you combine health and fitness with this emotional regulation and all that stuff?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. So I was in the corporate world for 13 years. And when I got separated as part of that cathartic, what am I doing with my life, you know, narrative that I explained a little bit earlier, I looked at career and I was making great money and I wanted to, but I wasn't fulfilled. I wasn't waking up with any fire. And so I decided to get into health coaching, which was more of my background at that time, which was, you know, looking at the physical side of health. And so I got certified as a personal trainer. I actually got certified in behavior change specialty as well. And I just started, you know, down that journey. And then, you know, I bring it back to the glass ceilings. When I started to break through my own, I realized that there was so much more above the head that was affecting physical health and everything like that. And so fast forward to a couple of years ago, I connected with my business partner, Ryan, who had a very well-oiled machine as it pertains to health and fitness and online programs and everything like that. And he was looking for a coach at the time to check in with his clients. And as I was checking in with his clients, I was noticing all these mindset things. And by that time I was, you know, 3 years into relationship coaching and I have this behavior change specialty. And so I kind of know what's going on above the neck. And as I'm checking in with these people, I'm finding, oh, you know, I said to this one client, I remember there was no tracking for a week, not a food, not an exercise, nothing. And I found it, oh, I got in a fight with my girlfriend and it's been a rough week. And I said, you know, why don't we hop on a mindset call? Let's just chop it up a little bit and find out what's going on. And so we did. We dug into it for, you know, 30, 40 minutes. He felt great afterwards. And the next week he was back to killing it. And so I was like, okay, we have something here, you know, mm-hmm. where we're not just giving you a nutrition plan and we're not just giving you a workout plan, but we actually focus on the entire transformation. You know, what's going on in the mind as much as what's going on in the body, because the two a lot of the time go hand in hand. And so that's how we came up with our company, Lifestyle Transformations. And here we are today.
Man, all that stuff merged together is so important, because I often find people will create pockets. Like I don't think you can actually resolve emotional stuff and your body stay the same. Like on the journey to the resolution of emotional wounds, let's call them, you're going to have an innate desire to quit drinking, to quit substances, exactly, to eat nutritionally. I do think though that you can go the fitness route and not the relationship route.
Yep.
Because I've seen that a lot. And I was thinking recently how you could have a fit body, but if you don't have healthy relationships, you're not actually healthy.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, like the inflammatory impact of high conflict relationships would negate a lot of the anti-inflammatory benefits of fitness. Not to say that it won't have a benefit. I'm just saying that it's not unlocking the full potential.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah.
It's, you know, we talk about the stress hormone a lot when we're talking to clients in the business, which is cortisol. Cortisol is our stress hormone, and that will stall fat loss, muscle growth, any type of physical improvement, that will stall it right away. So if you are, stressed in your job or you're stressed in your relationships or whatever life has to throw at you, if there's those stressors and you're not getting curious as to why they're there, you're kind of just operating on autopilot, means that, you know, there's a lack of curiosity there. That's kind of what, you know, the important part of digging into some and having these conversations. Like, I can't tell you how thrilled it makes me when I have a client book a mindset call, especially a male client, just, you know, because of the book and everything like that, because yeah. that means they're willing to talk. And that's such a powerful thing. And being able to navigate this and create a safe space to dig into some of these things while they're on their fitness journey. Cause primarily that's what we are. We are a health and fitness a company that, you know, will give you easy and sustainable ways to create these habits in your life, and you will get an incredible shape. But we don't want you to just be in incredible shape. We want you to feel like you're in incredible shape, you know?
Yeah, there's such a difference in vitality.
Oh,
you know,
huge.
Yeah, like when you're like, oh, I have good boundaries, your body will feel way different. And I think having, you can tell when someone has that highly strained, dysregulated fit body.
Yeah.
You know, where they're actually in a constant state of fight, and that's what creates their fitness motivation.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do we actually bring that back to a place of regulation? And the impact of, you know, doing things like spin 7 days a week is not good for you, and people being able to see that, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I have our clients do when they sign up, one of the first things we do that is outside of anything physical is I have them develop their why. And we really want to get intrinsic when we're talking about this. We don't, you know, if I hear a why, it's like, oh, I really want a six pack by summer. I really want to fit into that dress and stuff. That's great. Those are good little kind of goals along the way, but there's going to be no emotional attachment to that. So when motivation isn't present, you know, we really want a why. You know, I don't love the saying, but I believe in what it means. You know, you want to develop a why that makes you cry. Right. But
it essentially, I never heard that.
Never heard that? Yeah. Develop a why that makes you cry. And essentially you need some emotional attachment to it. Like mine is completely centered around my kids wanting to, you know, be able to play with them and never lose energy and live a long life and all of this stuff. It's my why. So when motivation's not there, I can read it and now I can kind of, determination will beat out motivation. That's one of the first things that people need to get clear on, because there can be a lot of emotional attachment to things like the scale. You know, if the scale goes up, oh my God, I'm disheartened and things like that. Well, no. I want you to get into a place of, how do you feel along this journey? A lot of people look at the outcome goal as, you know, the one that they're working towards. No, it's those process goals. It's falling in love with the journey, because ultimately when you get to the end goal, it's always a little emptier than you think. But if you can fall in love with the process and why you're doing it, that's what creates that sustainable change.
Yeah. To see who you are, you know,
see who you are.
Yeah. That's such a big thing. You know, like the evidence of your confidence, of your transformation, of your values, you know, coming back to where we began. Brother, where can people find more of you and your business and your book, all of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our website is www.lifestyletransformations.ca. You can find out more about our program, customized app, get in touch with us there. But the best place to get in touch with me is on good old Instagram, Mark, at Coach Chris Menz on Instagram. But we'll put the links in the show notes. But come find me over there. If you're interested in a transformation journey, having a conversation, send me a message. Hit the, you know, you can put the words Mark Grove so I know where you heard, and we'll make sure to take care of you. But my passion is helping people. It has been for a while, so this is the platform to do it.
Well, getting to hear your story of transformation and what you've been through, and, you know, knowing you personally as you've, you know, come forward with it and written that book, which is so incredible.
Thank you.
And to know that you're putting together all the things that woke you up have become your work, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, you make your mess your message, and I've certainly done that. But it's giving, you know, having this voice and putting it out there has not only changed my life, but you know, hearing that it's impacted other people's is just, I mean, I can't explain to you how fulfilling that is.
It's amazing. It's truly amazing. Thanks so much for your time, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.